It's time for Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you have a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now at 252-222-4848.
And with that, it's a pleasure to have joining us Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, Harvell and Collins. And gentlemen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Lockwood.
Good morning, Lockwood.
And so the topic for today, we're class is in session. This is always an enjoyable and informative program. So what is our topic today?
We're going to talk a little bit about spousal rights in the event of the death of a spouse. And particularly, Lockwood, we're going to talk about the right to an elective share. A lot of folks don't understand that you cannot, in North Carolina, disinherit your spouse. If you are married to someone, when you pass away, the surviving spouse always has a right to make a claim against the estate for what's called the elective share, unless there's a prenup in place that waives that, or another contract in place that would waive that, or if we're in a situation where the marriage has been abandoned, and then if it has been abandoned, then you're not entitled to that. But that's a pretty powerful right that is guaranteed in our statutes, that's referred to as the right to claim an elective share. So we'll talk about that a little bit this morning.
All right. I am interested in that term abandoned. Several questions popped in my mind, but what is the qualification for an abandoned marriage? I'm thinking in the case of a divorce, is that an example?
If there's a divorce, then obviously if it's an actual divorce, then, and there's a divorce decree in place or an order, then upon the death, if the husband and wife were no longer married, then the rights are severed or end as soon as that divorce is final.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's that. But typically, abandonment comes in two different forms. This is a situation where the husband and wife, or the spouses, are in fact married, but one of them has left the relationship without justification.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning not in the marital home anymore, not living under the same roof, but has probably the best term is abandoned the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the event that the abandonment under that scenario is justified, like if there's abuse in the home, then it's not considered abandonment. I mean, you, as a spouse, you don't have to stay in a situation that's dangerous to you, or that would reasonably, you know, a reasonable person, you know, would not stay involved in. So if you abandon or leave the relationship without reasonable justification, then you would be giving up rights to the elective share and other rights as well. The other category is when you engage in an uncondoned sexual relationship during the marriage. So really it's just leaving the marriage without justification or engaging in adultery.
Okay.
Those are the two categories.
Mm-hmm. Where this, though, Lockwood, more kind of sneaks up and spooks people is, let's talk about it a minute. A very typical situation is a second marriage or third marriage, where, you know, there's a lot of those out there now, and folks go into these marriages with the best of intentions, but they're saying to each other at home at the kitchen table every morning, they're saying things like, well, you know, you have everything. We know that we have agreed that you had your assets when you came into the marriage, and those are going to your children.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my assets that are going to my children. And we've agreed to that. We have discussed that you don't need to provide for me. I have my own set of assets. then I don't need to provide for you. And so our assets are separate and distinct from one another. And so they begin to make out last wills and testament that leave everything directly to their children. And they don't necessarily address this right to an elective share. So that is a problem in the state of North Carolina. And really is something that so few people, understand. I just had clients in, last Friday from Emerald Isle. They're in this situation of a second marriage. And he and she were just flabbergasted that they could not leave their respective estates, which were significant, just directly to their children. You know, my husband doesn't need my resources. My wife doesn't need my resources, and I would like to make sure that they go to my children. So in that particular file, due to the nature of the resources, we actually are going to be, we have advised that those folks are going to enter into a post-nuptial agreement. And they will both have to be independently represented by separate and distinct lawyers. But if they enter into a well-drafted post-nuptial agreement and have good lawyering, then we probably can begin to accomplish their goal. At the end of the conference, as you can imagine, Lockwood, they were not only flabbergasted, but they were just thrilled that this issue has been, you know, brought to their attention, and they now can deal with it effectively.
So there needs to be clarity in these relationships. A quick question on that scenario. Is there the ability of the children of one of the participants to demand that there be, to initiate the elective share? How far down the tree does this go?
Well, that's a good question, and we actually have had a very significant file in our office where the wife who was electing the share was doing so through her through the child's agency under a durable power of attorney.
Wow.
And so it is true that if the spouse is competent and fully informed, then only they are going to be able to elect the share.
Uh-huh.
They certainly are going to be influenced, Lockwood, by their adult children, like all of us are. But the bottom line is that the buck is going to stop with the competent and well-informed surviving spouse. But if the surviving spouse, and we see this often, is failing, okay, we're 85, mm-hmm. we're 92, and there is no clarity with the surviving spouse in terms of their competency, and maybe even one of their children is already acting under a power of attorney, then absolutely the control mechanism is going to be with the child.
Wow.
Another scenario, Lockwood, I mentioned the second marriages, but it doesn't have to be a second marriage. Let me hasten to say that. Let's say that we just had the good old career marriage, okay, going on, kind of like mm-hmm. you and your wonderful wife.
Right,
y'all
right.
been married yeah. for a long, long time, okay?
Yeah.
Now, we'll just leave those facts at that. The rest of the facts are not going to be applicable, but marriages that people have been married for 50 years, but yet, you know, a few years back, the wife inherited a very large sum of money through whatever means.
Uh-huh.
And now this money is in the marriage. Now, this is where the elective share law differs from the divorce law. Some folks know that divorce, that inheritance, if it's kept separate and distinct in a divorce matter, will not be included in the divorce proceeding, potentially, if it's kept separate and distinct. That's not the case with the elective share statute. If your career marriage wife or husband has inherited, $10 million from whatever source, and they want that to be directed directly to their children, which makes perfect sense, by the way.
Right.
Okay, you can see why we have a lot of files in this area of the law, because that's very logical. The career marriage people are already set financially. They're in their early retirement, let's say, or whatever the case might be. But then one of the spouses, it receives a large inheritance, and they want to keep it separate and distinct for their respective children, the grandchildren, if you will, of the parent. Well, the elective share statute is going to play in that file, Lockwood, and we're going to need to plan around that.
Wow. All right, we'll take a quick break on that. We've got Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us this morning. Harvell and Collins, and you know, as I said at the outset, class in session. To your point, Cecil and Wes, this is something that many of us have no knowledge of, but has a significant impact, particularly in the issue of the demise of one of the members of the family. We're coming back. We're talking about North Carolina's elective shares with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell. As we started the program this morning with Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, I said class in session, and I'm getting quite an education as well. I want to bring up the issue of inheritance. I've got a question for that for the two of you. But before I do, one more time, Wes, if you will, refresh us. What exactly is the elective share, and what is it unique? Why is North Carolina unique about that?
Right. Well, you know, of course, as I indicated from the beginning of the program this morning, the elective share is a right that a surviving spouse has to claim an amount of the estate of the deceased spouse. So it is statutory, meaning it is by law on our books something that you're guaranteed to have the right to claim. So what it basically breaks down to, as it relates to the amount, is based on how long the marriage lasted.
Okay.
So we're at, in the event that it was a 5-year or less marriage, it's 15%. If it was between 5 and 10 years, it's 25%. Between 10 and 15, 33%.
Ooh.
And over 15 is 50%. So we're talking about not just what we refer to, Lockwood, as probate assets,
mm-hmm.
which are things that are controlled by the will. But we're also talking about any joint accounts. We're talking about, surprisingly, life insurance. We're talking about annuities.
Wow.
We're talking about transfers of any assets without compensation within a year of death. You know, so it's a very broad definition and kind of what we would think of as a very wide net that is cast that we take into consideration for calculating what's referred to under the statute as the total net assets.
Mm-hmm.
We add all of that up, and once we add all that up, if we have a marriage that's over 15 years, then the surviving spouse is entitled to 50% of that, even if the will says, I leave her nothing,
right,
or I leave him nothing.
Right.
Okay? Now, that would be offset, meaning reduced by any amount that the spouse otherwise inherited as a result of the death. So let's say that let's use a large number. Let's say the total net assets are $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the marriage is over 15 years, then the surviving spouse, upon filing a proper elective share claim, will be entitled to $500,000.
Right.
But let's say that the surviving spouse received, as a result of the death of the deceased spouse, $100,000 anyway. Okay? She already got that.
Gotcha.
So that would be a minus. So it would be 500 minus 100.
I gotcha.
She'd be entitled to an additional $400,000. So that's a very crude explanation as to how that is generally calculated. Normally, it's a little more complicated than that because there's you know, various assets and offsets that we're having to use to calculate that.
Does this pose a problem in the case of an inheritance? Are there instances where an inheritance might be challenged as a result of the elective share?
Great question. You could certainly have a situation like Cecil was referring to before, where let's say that the one spouse inherits a huge amount of money. He used the amount $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they can inherit that on day one and then on the very next day pass away, and then that $10 million would be controlled by that person's estate. And then if the surviving spouse made a claim for elective share, even though that inheritance was just received, that still would go into the calculation of the total net assets. There's no, you know, it's kind of that interplay between domestic law, as Cecil was referring to, and estate law, where if this was an inheritance that was received directly from a parent, for example, or just directly from anyone, really, then yeah, that's generally going to be considered what's called a separate asset for purposes of dividing assets out under equitable distribution in a mm-hmm. divorce. Okay? But in the world, the estate world, that entire $1 million that would not be something that would be subject to division in a divorce would be subject to the elective share. So you can see how the water can get a little muddy.
And Lockwood, real quick.
Yep.
I wish I had not used such a large example, because $10 million, I mean, how many folks are floating around $10 million? Yeah. I've had files where it's just $250,000, $500,000, $700,000, a $700,000, you know, Edward D. Jones account that is inherited by the spouse. The spouse and the career spouse have sat down and said, well, no, that needs to go on to the children. That came from grandmama, granddaddy, that $700,000 account. It needs to go on to the children. Well, that's just fine to talk about that and promise to do that and say to do that. But then, of course, you know, when there are undue influences at play, then that $700,000 might just not make it where everybody intended it to go. It can be, it doesn't have to be any huge number like a $10 million mm-hmm. number.
Yeah. The aspect of this, and well, we'll take another break here in a moment, but the aspect of this, and I want to get your opinion or observations, is this is one of those situations where we don't know about it, but more importantly, and I'm wondering, this is a circumstance where if you are behind the power curve, if you fail to prepare for this, you could basically be out of luck, pure out of luck. I want to ask you about that in relationship to how people should set this their estates up. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Let's Talk Legal. And by the way, I just want to remind you, you're hearing this today. If you want to follow up with more information and want to engage their services, let me give you the number, 726-9050. That's 726-9050, 252 area code, of course, or you can go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. We have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins on the line this morning with Let's Talk Legal. And we were talking about the issue of, North Carolina electives, the elective share. Wes, Cecil, I said a moment ago, this is one of those situations where apparently you really have to be ahead of the game on this one. Is that correct?
Well, you really do. And, I mean, I will always recall, we don't have but so much time, but just very, very quickly, just the sweetest couple, just the most wonderful people in the world. Just, you know, and she was so, you know, southern and elegant, and he was a gentleman, and they were in their 80s, and they were in a second marriage. They had been in a second marriage for like 40 years, okay, for a very long time. But she had significant She had resources, uh-huh. and he had resources. And they had always, always known that their respective resources would go to their children. And that's just what they always had discussed. And so the next thing that happened is that he died, but when he died, she was infirm. She was under the care of her power of attorney.
Uh-huh.
And the agent under the power of attorney elected the share against his estate. And it was significant. I mean, you know, very significant. And that then went over to her side, even though she did not need it. And she never had expected to have it, but she was unable to communicate in a strong way that she was not going to elect that share. And then I want you to know that within a year and a half, she then died.
Mm.
And so that one half that she elected went to her children to the exclusion of the children of the husband. And you're absolutely right, which is why I brought this up. As an example, Lockwood, there's nothing that could be done about it.
Right.
I mean, that's just the way it is. Now, you know, Wes, a litigator, could potentially say that there was, you know, maybe fraud, maybe the power, mm-hmm. use of the power of attorney for that purpose was aggressive and fraudulent and things of that nature. But that's going to be a pretty difficult case. Don't you agree, Wes?
I do, and to what Lockwood is stating, or a question that he has, you can plan ahead. So under this scenario, if these folks had wanted to set up an elective share trust to provide for their surviving spouse, then that's an option. So you can then pass the elective share amount into a trust so that the surviving spouse receives the income of it off of whatever that amount is. But the principle stays intact and then passes down, for example, to the grandkids. So that planning technique is there, but Lockwood, like you said, you have to stay ahead of that. You can't do that after the death. You have to have that plan in place before either of the spouses were to pass away.
We've talked about this in the past. As we wrap it up, these are situations where services such as Harvell and Collins offer designed to not only save money, and it does, but above all, it saves disputes, unnecessary family disputes. And as the stories and the scenarios you're just sharing with us, you know, I cringe for all the family members, and I would also argue even for those that are representing the families, as you have to deal with this. As we tell people, the issue of good planning starts with a plan, and starting with Harvell and Collins. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us this morning. Let's Talk Legal. Gentlemen, I do appreciate this. And the website, by the way, is harvellandcollins.com, harvellandcollins.com, 726-9050.